Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. On this edition of Line One, the emphasis is going to be on the first 1,000 days of brain development. I really have come to think of this as probably one of the very most important recent advances in understanding the brain that affects us all, and hopefully by the end of the program you're going to understand that. These first 1,000 days have lifelong impact. In addition, time allowing, we're going to take a little bit of a brief tour of autism. Our guest today is Anchorage developmental behavioral pediatrician Sue Fossey. Dr. Fossey is a member of the Providence Medical Group Alaska's Neuroscience Clinic and working closely with the community to expand neurodevelopmental services in Alaska. Dr. Fossey, it's a pleasure to have you here, and welcome to Alaska, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
As our listeners may know, you can reach us over the next 45 to 50 minutes several different ways. If you're local, you can call us directly with any questions or comments. The number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So, although it's contrite and we do it all the time, tell us a little bit about your training yourself and what brought you to Alaska.
Sure. My husband brought me to Alaska because he's an avid outdoorsman, and he really has always wanted to live around the mountains and be able to have our kids experience that type of upbringing. So I came with two children, my 15-year-old daughter and my 12-year-old son, along with my husband. In terms of my training, I'm a pediatrician by training, so I did a pediatric residency, and after that residency, I decided I needed to learn more about childhood development and behavioral disorders, so went to Boston and did a fellowship in development and behavior, and while I was there, I was able to work in the developmental medicine center, where I worked with amazing people in evaluating and assessing children with all types of different developmental differences and learning differences. And after that, my daughter was born, and we decided we needed to go back to Texas for our family and that level of support. And at that time, we were just starting to understand neurodevelopment and kind of how to really help families navigate some of those interventions and treatments. And at the time of my career, I wanted to go back into general pediatrics. I felt like I was able to learn a lot more than I did in just my pediatric residency, and I love the longitudinal approach to caring for children. So I struggled a little bit with stepping aside from that type of specialty practice in assessing children and weighing in, do I want to specialize, or do I really want to work with families along their lifespan? And so I decided to do the latter, which is be a general pediatrician. So I enjoyed that. I did that in different settings, private practice, community health centers, and I really felt like that helped me have a very strong foundation in what was normal development and what may be development that's more derailed. Mm-hmm. And so apart from my training, I actually feel like it was that experience as a general pediatrician that allowed me to be able to be a better diagnostician, trying to separate out what's normal variant in terms of a child's development and what's delayed and what may be disordered. I think takes that experience of working with families that just have regular everyday questions and really understanding that broad range of variability.
If you don't mind, flesh out a little bit better the range of specific problems, topics, not only that you have personal interest in, but what developmental pediatricians do.
So that's a very good question. Developmental behavioral pediatricians, we are trained in understanding development and its trajectories, as well as what may be associated with them. So I think that looking at the difference between a child who may be delayed in one area of development, like speech or motor, and trying to figure out, then are they just late talkers or late walkers, versus a child who may have a delay in more than one area of development, and maybe that signifies a more significant developmental disorder rather than just a developmental delay. And then there are different scopes of practices for developmental behavioral pediatricians. So sometimes we work in university or academic centers where we're fortunate enough to have psychologists and speech therapists and neuropsychologists work as part of a multidisciplinary team to really provide a comprehensive assessment for children with developmental issues, all the way to maybe private practices where you're choosing to focus on very specific areas of development and disorders themselves. So working with kids with just speech and language or communication disorders, working with children with ADHD, working with children with autism, working with adolescents with different types of mood and behavior disorders. So there's quite a bit of difference in terms of a practice, not only based on location, but based on, I guess, areas of interest.
All right. I have a couple of years under my belt just looking at you compared to you. And I came out of training in 78, came up here actually with the CDC for a couple of years as an epidemiologist and ended up going into private practice. And in those days, I would see a couple of cases of meningitis, worried about epiglottitis, used to see osteomyelitis, infection of the joints, bad infections. Primary reason for people in my age group of kids was to be in the emergency room was illness, you know, infections. And now, I haven't seen a case of meningitis in over 10 years, maybe longer. Haven't seen epiglottitis. Seen maybe one osteomyelitis in the last couple of years. And what I do now, I wasn't trained to do. I see a lot of kids. I'm worried about autism. I see a lot of developmental stuff. I see a lot of need for parents to understand the importance of early childhood development. I see a lot of anxiety. I see a lot of ADHD. So my thought is the current pediatrics is changed because of our control of infectious diseases to a large degree is now developmental pediatrics is what I think. And clearly there's more information out there for developmental pediatricians and so forth. So we've basically are doing not to the degree that you're doing it and certainly not to the training, but does that dawn on you or does that make sense to you also?
Absolutely. I think I was starting to see it in my own pediatric residency, and that's where I decided that the hospital-based acute care training that we were receiving is really important because as pediatricians, we're the specialists for children. So we need to be able to identify and help children improve not only in their physical health, but also in other areas. And where when I completed my residency training, I felt very comfortable and confident in hospital-based care. I, like you at the time, did not feel comfortable with the larger number of concerns of families coming in that their child wasn't maybe behaving in a way that would help them be successful in school or be able to use their words to communicate or not being successful in school after a few years. And so there certainly has been, I would say, a new morbidity now that is evolving. And maybe some of that is our improved ability to use technology and care for children that are that we never really had an opportunity to see their outcome for. So if we take, for example, NICU follow-up children that are graduates.
Yeah, NICU, neonatal intensive care follow-up, okay?
Right. So now I'm seeing children that are born so early, and not only are they not physically handicapped, you can't tell the difference between these babies that were born 3 months early and their peers anymore when they start kindergarten, other than they may struggle with more the higher cognitive and language functions. And so I think as technology has improved, as our medical care has gone better, as our ability to reduce the number of infectious diseases through vaccination programs, through all of these advances in medicine, we've done it maybe without taking a pause and considering the effects that it may be having on a child's brain who is very vulnerable when they're younger, or who's very vulnerable when they are that premature. Yeah.
Another way of kind of saying it is, nowadays, typically, I'm spending more time, my nurse and I, triaging people out of the office by telephone about illnesses that we used to spend all of our day seeing, because we know the likelihood of serious complications is so low, again, because of the infectious diseases. And we're now able to spend more time asking about the social issues, the development. So we're not only more aware of the problems, we have more time to spend on the problems. It's dramatically changed the time. And the typical visit now for us is getting into preventative health care and the whole range of that, particularly with behavioral aspects of it. Much, much different than what we did it early. So we spend more time with patients than we used to as well.
And I believe even with antibiotics, we've gotten so good at treating, like you said, the infectious diseases that, you know, we're almost taking for granted healthcare. Because a lot of the parents I see of this generation haven't seen the more significant illnesses. If you haven't seen them, then certainly the parents of this generation probably have not.
Which brings up another set of problems, but we don't have to go there yet. If people haven't seen them, then it must not exist or it's not that bad, and it's not true. All right, so let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Sue Fossey. She is a developmental behavioral pediatrician working with Providence Medical Group's neuroscience clinic. And if you've got questions or comments about what we're discussing today, three ways to get a hold of us. A local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1. You need to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, so let's get to this issue that I think is so important for everyone out there to understand, and that's the first 1,000 days of life. I'm going to just leave it open-ended and see where you want to go with this.
So what brought me back into focusing in on development and behavior, having been in general pediatrics, is the neuroscience that has come about in the last 20 years regarding early brain development and the neuroplasticity. And that science, even when I was in residency, wasn't strong, very strong. It just came out with the Neurons to Neighborhoods book, and at the time we were still trying to understand it and making sure that that knowledge was being shared out to the communities, and that we were investing in our children early on, not just to get them ready for school, but even in that first 2 to 3 years of life, the early intervention programs that are helping parents know how to engage and interact, and all those interpersonal skills that are so important to in teaching a child how to self-soothe and self-regulate. And so that the science behind that area of child development has really changed also in not just my interaction with families, but also in my recommendations regarding treatment and interventions. So I was excited to come back, though I love general pediatrics, in that now I felt like I could make more of a difference as a developmental behavioral pediatrician. I felt a little bit as a fellow that it was a lot of doom and gloom, to be honest. It wasn't the prognosis at the time when we were helping families understand why their child may be delayed wasn't so great. But now, with what we're understanding about the first 100 days, 1,000 days, 2 to 3 years of development where their brain is continually to changing based on the experiences that a child has, we can guide parents in that. We can help them understand that if you engage in your child in, through play and through face-to-face interactions, you are making a difference in their brain development, not just in their behaviors, but you're actually changing how their brain is molded and shaped.
I want to try to take you back, if you'll let me, back into just the basic science of the neuron and synapses for a second. So how I engage parents is early on is I say, you know, you get 80% of your adult head size in the first couple of years of life. And, you know, that kind of amazes people. They all recognize babies have big heads. And then I say, you know, that happens without more neurons being formed, and it happens, you know, without the neurons getting bigger. So how does the brain grow so much if there's not more cells and the cells don't get bigger? And then I start talking about dendrites. Would you mind talking about why that brain grows so fast and why this is such a critical point from a physiologic and anatomical point of view?
So the way that we learn and develop is through the connections from the different neurons in the different cell bodies. So dendrites are the connections between how our brain cells speak to each other and communicate. And so that connectivity and that space in between the brain cells, which dendrites are the extension of that, are called synapses. And synapses can be, so our brain cells can talk to each other through neurotransmitters, and it can talk to each other electrically. There's different ways that our brain can communicate, but the growth that happens is in the synapses, the brain's connections and its circuitry. And so as our brain is starting to learn function and starting to learn what those cells need to do to be able to help the individual separate out the functions of their body, they're building these connections. And so the other thing to keep in mind is not only in the growth of these connections, but the other really important thing is the pruning process. Mm-hmm. So between 2 to 3 years of age, our brain starts to decide what's important, what are the important connections, and what's not so important, what don't we need anymore. So as babies, we have a lot of involuntary movements, we have a lot of exaggerated startle reflexes, and our nervous system is considered immature. So even though we have a lot of connections, the function isn't well established yet. So what's really important is having those experiences to be able to prune away those connections that are really unnecessary and that are getting in the way, and really making those connections stronger that are purposeful, intentional, that help us to interact, help us to communicate, and help us to self-regulate. And if we're better regulated, we actually can learn from our environment, mm-hmm. and we're not distressed.
Let me take you a little bit further into this in the way my mind thinks and the way I understand it. So what I hear you saying is that we're born with a certain number of cells, there's some dendrites around, but as we experience life early in the environment, everything, the breeze on our face, the smell, the taste of mother's milk, what we see happening in our environment is causing these dendrites to begin to interact through synapses with other neurons. And that is why our brain is growing. And it's been said that neurons that fire together, grow together, something like that. And so we really set up physical circuits very much like a computer does. And the more we use those circuits, the faster and more accurately they function. And that leads to a better understanding of why this early environment is very important. And then you added this idea, which is very important, I think. It helps us understand things like amblyopia and congenital deafness in kids, is cells that are not being stimulated, not being used, not being taken advantage of. Our body says, I don't want to waste a lot of energy on that, and they prune those things away. So children who can't see well at birth, can't hear well at birth, after a certain critical period, you can't do anything about it. Those cells are gone. Am I putting all that together in a way that makes sense, or am I overstating it?
No, I think that was a beautiful description of what happens to the brain in terms of the early childhood period. The other piece that's really helpful to kind of take a look at is the resiliency at that time. So you had mentioned strabismus or losing vision in one eye, if the anatomy makes it difficult to focus, and our brain kind of shuts that out. The other thing that we do in terms of helping a child regain cortical vision is we patch the good eye. So we're forcing the brain to accommodate for the loss of vision that may be happening because of a child's anatomy, and making the brain work and build other connections around that so that eventually they can have good functional vision. And the same with cochlear implants. We've learned that if we can supply a child who is hearing impaired with a way to process sound before their speech develops, then we can help their brain be able to build that circuitry to where they can actually develop some speech.
And that gets into a little bit of maybe listeners are wondering, what about neuroplasticity and what does that mean? And so how does the idea of neuroplasticity come into, well, you know, so here's a child who wasn't recognized that they couldn't hear well until they were three, or a child who had a tendency to eye cross and get double vision, and the brain starts suppressing some vision and turning off or not working with neurons. So how does plasticity come into effect then? How does the brain compensate for this neurons that have been pruned away? Is that what neuroplasticity is all about?
Yes, so they're going to recruit other nearby neurons that can help them fire and build that team. And so with a young brain, there's a lot of possibility in terms of I can do more things if you help me. So they recruit other nearby brain cells, and then they start firing, and then they're teaching each other to be able to have function that maybe they weren't going to do without that neuroplasticity, that ability to change from one function and be able to learn and team up and be able to help recruit other brain cells to be able to learn how to do a function. So if you try to do the same type of intervention in an adult or in an older child, it's not that we can't continue to learn skills, but that rate becomes decreased. So that ability to recruit and use other parts of our brain to help restore function starts to decrease over time. We don't have the same number of connections and brain cells that we would do in the first 1,000-2,000 days of life. And so there's that critical period, but I also want to also say that it's not closed completely. There's along the lifespan, even into adulthood or even later adulthood, there's always that crack or that window that you can still improve function through this idea of neuroplasticity is just the likelihood and the advantage of doing it in a younger brain makes the outcome much better than if you're trying to do it later.
We've alluded to it already, but there are critical periods for certain kinds of developmental abilities to maximize the use of those neurons and set up these circuits. Do you want to comment maybe about those that are most important in these first couple of years of life? We've alluded to hearing and vision, but I think things like behavioral control or emotional control and other things are also critical at this particular time.
Yeah, so along with the resiliency that is had with neuroplasticity, there also is vulnerability. So the critical period goes both ways. So in the first 12 months of life, if a child is not actively engaged with their mother through conversation, through cooing back and forth, through face-to-face interaction, through being held, through being soothed, rocked, if you're not getting that social-emotional support for your needs, there may also be a higher risk of negative impact. So learning that you have a caretaker that is there builds an attachment and allows other areas of your brain that are responsible for emotional regulation, which often can manifest as different types of behavioral issues when we can't help take care of our own emotional needs. All of that is set up in the first 1,000 days of life. So it's really important not just for our physical, cognitive, and language development. It's really also important to understand that the first 1,000 days can also be derailed if we don't have attentive, interactive caregivers.
I need to take a break, but before I do this, how do you define the first 1,000 days? I always thought it was the first 3 years of life, and then it became important to me to recognize that it's also from conception. The brain starts developing very early, so it's not only the environment after you're born, it's the environment while you're developing in the uterus. Is that the way you think of it?
It is, and I'm so glad you brought that up because we forget the whole fetal development
right.
of our brain and our nervous system and the impact of different types of experiences and exposures and stress and those kind of things even prior to birth that our central nervous system is already starting to develop, and by the time that a child is born, structurally is already developed.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps after the break we can get into how the environment can absolutely change the way genes even turn off. Genes are controlling when things turn on and off in our body, but now we recognize where you are, what you're doing, what you're eating, what's in your intestines, who's talking to you, can have significant impacts on the effects of these genes, a very, very interesting area of the knowledge that has developed. But before we do that, and if we decide we really want to go there, I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Again, our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussions on the lifelong importance of early childhood environment. And time allowing, we'll talk a little bit about autism. My guest is Dr. Sue Fossey. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
All right, welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm your host, actually your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And today we're discussing the effects of the environment on the first 1,000 days of human brain development. If you have not listened to the first part, please go back and listen to this. You can go to alaskapublic.org. You can find our archives and listen to this at any time. It's really important you understand the early child development because everything else flows from that. And believe it or not, things that happen in those first 1,000 days can, in some people, predict their lifespan. Certain things they're going to do in later in life that may affect their health. It's worth understanding this in great detail. You can also put, there's a number of very good websites listed on our, for more resources listed on our website as well. At again, if you go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Line 1 link, you'll get those resources as well. My guest, I failed to mention on since we've come back, is Anchorage Developmental Behavioral Pediatrician Dr. Sue Fossey. She's recently joined the Providence Medical Group Alaska's Neuroscience Clinic and is helping broaden the ability of our community to look into neurodevelopmental services. Also, as you probably know, you can call us locally at 550-8433 if you've got questions or comments. We'll be here for another 30 minutes, roughly 29, 28 minutes. You can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast, and we can't answer your questions. So we've kind of fleshed out the superficial idea that should help people understand that once you learn how to ride a bike, because there's now a physical wired together bunch of neurons that are getting stimulated, you don't unlearn how to ride a bike. That's pretty clear. So everything we're learning very early in life is set down in some kind of hard wiring. It is not the end of the world, but it does help us understand why change can be very difficult. While my eating habits, maybe I can change them for a month or two, but I have a tendency to go back to the same circuit later in life. And why changes in adolescent behaviors can be so much more difficult than changing in infant behaviors. Hopefully people are beginning to understand that. But one bit of research that started, which has truly revolutionized our understanding of the consequences of understanding early child development, is these early childhood experiences studies, what are called ACEs studies. Do you mind kind of talking briefly about those studies and where they've taken us?
So looking at adverse childhood events is what ACEs stands for. The study was looking at individuals who had a number of psychosocial stressors and or health stressors and trying to understand the impact of that. What the study is telling us is that the impacts that happened in the first 3 years of life are lifelong in terms of their consequences. In the way that a child's brain is wired is not something that is a short-term difference, but it can influence and impact their decision-making and their physical health even as they become adults. So it's really important to kind of consider those first few years and what a child's brain has had to learn to overcome. And I think part of that, some of that is, yes, these children underwent quite a few periods of trauma or had to deal with a lot more. But what we're understanding is that if we can help them to build resiliency, if we know and we support them through these difficult times. And it's helping us as healthcare providers kind of go back and really ask about that. I think we've been trained to do different types of histories looking at birth and pregnancy and the types of things that may influence that. But now we're really understanding we've got to ask a little bit more about what's happened to their family, not just in this generation, but the generation before that. And that those changes, those family dynamics are influencing the child's brain now and in the futures to come.
Let's go ahead and take a phone call. We had somebody call in. I want to see what Robert has to say. Robert, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, hi. How are you guys doing? Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. What's your question?
You might have just touched on it real quick, but I have a young son, and, you know, it's that time of life where all my friends have young children. I just wanted to ask a quick question. It's been kind of a debate, is the purple crying, whether or not it's okay to let a young child kind of cry it out, because it's a different type of crying than, you know, what an adult would consider crying.
Yeah. I mean, question you get about, I'm not sure I've heard the term purple crying. I guess you talk about the fact they cry so hard they turn blue or purple?
No, not that at all. It's just kind of, purple crying is, it's some silly term that I kind of only heard of in passing, haven't really looked into it.
All right.
But it's kind of, not if, you know, the child sounds like they're in pain or anything like that, but they're just kind of, you know, they can cry for hours and hours, and people think that that's just how that baby is, and that if there's not an awful lot you can do it, you should just kind of accept that.
Yep. What age group are we talking about?
First 1,000 days, first, you know, up to 3-4 years before, you know, before a child is able to effectively communicate.
Okay. So the question is it okay to let a child cry, or is it, the question is, it depends on why they're crying or how long? I'm trying to make sure.
Yeah,
I understand.
That's kind of the question.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah, that boils it down.
Good. Good. All right. I'm going to ask Dr. Fassi to comment.
So I think there's been long debates on whether the crying out approach, letting a child cry themselves to sleep. I think that's what you're referencing. Let me know if I'm not on the right track. But the key to that is understanding your child's temperament, understanding your child's ability to be able to self-soothe and self-regulate, and then also understanding your own temperament and your own personality. So a lot of my fellowship training was in this idea of goodness of fit, this idea of a child's personality or temperament may or may not fit the parent's personality or temperament. And so, you know, it's not about the crying. It's about understanding your child's needs. And for some children, that's letting them cry. And for other children, they need more support than that. So trying to, I would say that the approach is not in the behavior itself, but in really understanding your child's temperament and then your own.
Great. Thank you.
Another factor might be why they're crying. The crying out at night is often a big issue that pediatricians run into. And I often mention to parents that they ask me how long they should let a child cry because they're trying to train them to sleep through the night. And I mentioned you probably wouldn't ask me that if they were playing with a light socket. You know they can't play with a light socket. And so you will let them cry however long they want. You're not gonna change your mind about it. It's the sleeping through the night is a much more difficult question because they hear different things, they have different backgrounds. We all want to get a good night's sleep. The child who is persistent and intense is going to make it much, much harder to change that behavior. But the issue in that sense is, what's the behavior you're trying to, what's the reason you want to change that behavior, rather than how long you should let them cry and so forth. Does that make sense? So it's another aspect, is what's the reason for going on, not only the temperament and the child, the family's situation. So you would agree with that sometimes the reason for that their crying might impact on how long you might want them to let them cry.
Right. I think that if a child is crying, I look at the behavior in terms of what is the function of that behavior. So I think in that way, it's similar to what you're saying. What is the situation?
Right.
So are they crying because they just don't want to go to bed because they, you know, they would rather be with their family? Are they crying because they're overtired and they actually do need to go to bed? Are they? So I look at a behavior in terms of a symptom of what is the actual function of this right now? What are they trying to do? And then by determining what the function is, I can better explain the intervention for that.
So all this gets very complex. I've had, speaking about ACEs, where there were a number of childhood bad experiences and basically involved abuse, neglect, and then household dysfunction. There was a high percentage, and there's a lot of individuals. The higher the number of these exposures, the more likely these children ended up with rather difficult psychosocial problems later in life. So it was very predictable. It's been repeated in a number of different ways. But I've had parents come to me and say, hey, I am very aware of ACEs. I am not going to let my child cry for hours and hours at night because I don't want to make them have a high ACE score, or I believe that's going to be an issue. So it really can get extremely complex. How do you answer or respond to that kind of response?
I think with the ACEs study, it wasn't around letting your child cry at night. It was really more like you had alluded to children who had been neglected or abused or had witnessed trauma, had actually been dealing with chronic medical conditions. So I think it's a little bit more than that. And the ACEs study, I think, helped us to really appreciate that we need to consider the additive effects of what a child's brain is going through in those first 1,000 days. And there's importance in understanding not just studies in terms of how they can be helpful in our medical practice, but also, really, I encourage families to read these studies for themselves and not really just take what I say as an expert or what other people have interpreted, but really go back to these studies and read them for yourselves and see, does this mean something to me? Is this something that I need to understand, and will it help me be better attuned to my child's needs and my needs? One of the scores on the ACEs study was also maternal depression, and talking about that decrease or reduced interaction where a mom is struggling with her own emotional battles and not being able to provide their child with the liveliness of a cheerful face and play and being able to have different conversations to help their brain be able to hear a variety of sounds. And so when we don't have that to bounce back to us as a baby, we tend to be still ourselves and to be quiet ourselves. And so I think as we have these important conversations and we talk about these important studies, I would encourage our listeners to find and research these studies for themselves and read it and bring these questions up to discussion.
I would go to, if you're really interested, go to the Harvard Center for the Developing Child. It's one of my favorite places, and there are other links, as I would point out, on our website if you want to get into this more. Melissa, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have a question regarding exposure to lead. My granddaughter is about 2.5 years old. They just found out that they lived in a place with paint chipping that was lead-based, and they did her blood work. It was, the level was 12. She's had she doesn't speak at all, really. And they said that can be one of the effects of lead exposure. She's right. been exposed probably since birth. So I was wondering about how the brain will it come back from this kind of exposure?
Right. So a 2.5-year-old girl not talking and has had some lead exposure, and how does that play into all of what we've talked about? And if there are effects from the lead, how remedial is that? Is the question, I understand.
So lead is a known neurotoxin, meaning that it does have negative consequences to a child's brain. And the thing is that it's a exposure that we can actually work to limit. So if we know that that may have been a contributing factor for her speech delay or developmental delays, then doing all we can to really remove that exposure from her environment and in trying to lessen that, then that also tells me if we remove the exposure, we can, and we provide early intervention through speech therapy and other developmental activities to promote her speech and language development, she's still at an early stage in her brain's development that she could, through neuroplasticity, start to recover without that exposure. Now, if there's an underlying reason outside of the lead exposure for her to also have speech and language problems, that's an added layer to her situation. But if it was really primarily due to lead, that's something we can try to minimize and through environmental controls.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So lead could be a possibility. It could be one of one or more factors that are leading to it. And that's where things can get very difficult, and perhaps where a developmental behavioral pediatrician could be very helpful.
Right. I think she has gone to a speech therapist already, mm-hmm. and they've removed her from the exposure to the lead.
Yep.
So I think I'm very hopeful.
We should have said that. That would be one of the very important first things. Does she live up here or she lives somewhere else?
She lives somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, there is some lead-based pain. I always used to think that most of the development in Alaska was such that we didn't have exposure to lead-based pain. It's not nearly the same as it is in other parts of the world, or the country anyway, but we still have some potential exposure. That's why I asked that question.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she did remove her right away. They're getting the health department involved, and, I'm pretty hopeful, like I said. I just was wondering if, it's kind of scary to get
yep.
those levels
right.
drawn, and knowing that since infancy she's been exposed to it, so...
By the way, that's one of the really true indicated situations for chelation, which we hear about, which is used inappropriate a lot of times. So anyway, good luck with that, and hopefully everything will turn out, Melissa.
Yeah, she said that she wasn't at a level that they would do
Okay.
So
yep.
that's kind
yep.
of a good thing, too, because
yep.
I know that can be a serious treatment.
Yes.
So.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
All right.
it.
Yep. Thanks for listening. So maybe this is a way we can get into autism. I promise listeners we talk about it a little bit. So how much of autism is due to all these developmental things that are happening in our environment, and how much is genetics, and what is autism anyway? in 2 minutes or less. Now we've got a little bit longer than that.
So autism is a very complex, and I use the term heterogeneous, meaning that the presentation of it can look very different depending on the child. So what it is a neurodevelopmental disorder that affects how a child socializes and communicates, and there tends to be some areas of behaviors that are more common in children that do have autism. Their brain development, I would like to say, is not necessarily delayed, but their brain is learning by their own circuitry. So they have different areas of connections that are stronger than what we would see in typically developing children. So when I look at a child's development, I try to see if we're dealing with just delays in development, so a child who may be later to talk, or is he learning speech and communication in a different way? And so if they're learning differently, then I approach that type of assessment a little bit different. So in order to meet criteria or have a diagnosis of autism, there needs to be those three areas of deficit, so social, communication, and then restricted interest, repetitive behaviors. Under the new DSM-5 criteria, they have lumped social and communication together, and that's to be able to capture individuals that may not have had speech delay, but their speech and language is different. They do tend to speak maybe on the same topics or their interest, and they may have a more repetitive way of using words or phrases. So there's a difference in their in their speech and in the way they communicate, even though they don't have speech delay. But you can't have autism without that constellation of findings. So a child who only has the speech and doesn't have the restricted interest repetitive behaviors would not have autism. And also a child who has speech and communication issues without the restricted speech and social issues, but not the restricted interest repetitive behaviors under DSM-5 would also not have autism. So there are children that have that latter profile where it's just speech and language communications and social deficits that may meet a new diagnostic category under DSM-5, which is social communication disorder. So social communication disorder encompasses both the way we use our words to communicate, as well as the way we use body language and the purpose for our words, which is to be able to interact and relate to others. But they don't have the restricted interest repetitive behaviors. And in the previous DSM or Diagnostic Statistic Manual that we use for diagnosis, in that fourth edition, a lot of those individuals would have been diagnosed with PDD and OS. We have a new diagnostic category now to help capture some of those individuals that may not meet the new DSM-5 criteria for autism, but would have met the DSM-4 PDD and OS.
And PDD is pervasive developmental disorder, which can look, to me, quite similar.
Well, pervasive developmental disorder was the term, was mm-hmm. the label or the name that we use for autism spectrum disorder. So there's actually been a name change from DSM-4 to DSM-5.
What are the earliest signs? Those are things that parents may want us to talk about. I'm trying to think in the last couple minutes, what are the important issues?
So some of the earliest signs is really ability to imitate the as an infant, we're using our vision and our ability to process sounds to be able to relate and interact to with our caregivers. And so, what I look at even in the first 12 months of age is really that level of engagement and that ability to imitate and even do things, really understand that if I'm cooing, my mother or my father, my caregiver will actually coo back at me. So that's the very first social milestone of being able to engage someone in play and in activity. So looking at that, also looking at a child's eye contact and how they're using their eyes, or are they able to kind of look at a caregiver and use their eyes to be able to connect and also to communicate. So we use our eyes to tell other people that we would like something by looking at that. And once we develop the fine motor skill to be able to point, we then pair that eye contact with the ability to point. So between a year, 10 to a year and a half, children should be pointing and using up to 16 gestures to be able to communicate with their parents. And that can be conventional gestures like pointing, that can be descriptive gestures like, oh no, I did something wrong, or that can be shaking our head, that can be clapping, waving. So there are a variety of gestures that pre-verbal children will use to be able to communicate their wants and their needs. Most of the time, children should not be leading or pulling their caregivers or parents. So that type of communication would signal to me that there's some impairment in their ability to initiate using language or using gestures. So by physically directing an adult to get your needs met, that's a very lower level communication skill. So that would be a little bit of a red flag for me. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, not responding to your name, so a baby will understand language way before they're able to use words. So they should be able to first understand familiar words such as their name, mom, dad, things that they like to eat or play with every day. So another red flag would probably be not responding to your name. So if a one-year-old didn't look when you called their name, I would have some concern for that.
I wish we had more time. These are the kinds of programs that I could sit here and talk all day, but unfortunately we have about a minute left. And so how do I use this most efficiently? I have stumbled on the idea to ask my guests, what's the most important things we want to take away from today's program? What do you want me to understand about what you do, or something about something we've talked about, or you want the listeners to take away?
I think it's important to understand that all children are different, that that children bring about their own individual personalities and temperaments, strengths and weaknesses, and that every child has the potential to learn and every child has the potential to develop. And to what level of support they need that, that's where we come in, is to try to identify a child's learning differences, their developmental profile, their temperament, and help parents be able to appreciate that in their child, and that we all have a role, that our brain is not static. The development of our brain is not static. Our genes, we didn't really talk about epigenetics, but our genes don't predetermine who we are. Our experiences have a lot to do with it. And just kind of finishing off with the whole epigenetics topic is that we can change the outcome through experiences. Even if our genes tell us otherwise, you can turn them on and you can turn them off.
Thanks very much. We'll have to do this again, and maybe then we can talk about how the environment works through our genes to affect brain development and outcomes as well. My thanks to Dr. Sue Fossey for being with us today. If you want to continue the discussion, you can join KSK on Facebook. That link is at alaskapublic.org. Next week, Prentice Pemberton is going to talk about how we can all work together to change ourselves a little bit better with his guest Bill O'Hanlon. That would be Monday, March 26th. Thanks to Dave Waldron, who's our engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day, and be careful how you talk to those kids out there.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.